commissioner of Meridian.
All right, thank you, Darrell. Yeah, I realize that a lot of folks have been here a lot today, and I know some of you have flights to catch and places to get going, so if some of you end up leaving at 3:30 or there, I understand that happens. So, but now let's turn it over to Basin. You're the last in the chute today, so the best for last, right?
Well, thank you for the opportunity for us to have the last word on this issue. We appreciate it.
For today.
For today. First of all, I'd like to introduce the people who are with me up here and have them give their title and their involvement with 111D at Basin Electric.
Yeah, I'm Lyle Witham. I'm the manager of environmental services for Basin Electric. I've been in that position for 7 years. In terms of working on the issue of climate change and natural resource law, I'm a lawyer by training. I was an assistant attorney general for 16 years, and we're primarily on these same issues that 111D deals with in terms of division of authority between EPA and the state under the Clean Air Act, authority of Minnesota to regulate regulatory decisions in terms of building generation. I represented North Dakota for the PSC and the state of North Dakota in the externalities case that went from 94 to 98. So in terms of being focused on this rule, I actually have been for about the last 3 or 4 years. We were involved with some organizations that tried to influence the rule prior to a publication. Maybe we did a little bit, maybe we didn't, but there's some good things in this rule for North Dakota. There's some bad things, and I'd like a chance to talk about that after Dale gets through with his comments.
Good afternoon. I'm Jim Sheldon, power supply engineer at Basin Electric. I work in the cooperative planning department, which is a long-term planning for generation assets. I'm involved in the CO2 work group, I guess we call it, a group of departmental folks that are put together to, you know, review the rule, write comments on it, and so on and so forth.
If it's all right with you, Commissioner, we'd like to just really kind of address, first of all, some of the questions that have come up before and comments that have been made to give a overview of that before we jump into the presentation. The information has been very good. We appreciate everyone taking the time to listen or to give their thoughts on it. We were all very interested in what the other utilities in the state were thinking and doing on this issue as well. To give you what we ended up doing was putting just a very basic presentation together on just specifically the rule and what we saw as the problem with the rule. With what's going on before, we'll like to give you an overview of Basin Electric situation in the states and in the plants and where we're at, so you've got a good grasp of where we're at. As you know, we're a generation transmission cooperative based in Bismarck. We serve more than 2.9 million consumers. We have 136 rural electric distribution co-ops across 9 different states. We've got a diverse energy portfolio, including coal, wind, natural gas, and nuclear. And more than a decade ago, we built the first commercial-scale wind projects in the Dakotas, and commitment to the environment was one of our founding principles more than 50 years ago.
Dale, can you give us the 9 states again for the people?
States are going to be Montana, Wyoming, North Dakota, South Dakota, Minnesota, Iowa, Nebraska, Colorado, New Mexico. Is that 9? I didn't count them. The main core is going to be Montana, Wyoming, the Dakotas, Minnesota, Iowa, Nebraska. With our plan overview, I think in the state, let's start with the state level. When we look at the numbers that came out, and again, it's been said many times, North Dakota is sitting in a pretty good situation with the numbers we received from EPA. South Dakota, where we have a lot of wind generation, numbers are a lot tougher. But the situation is we've had coal in North Dakota, wind in South Dakota. We've also got coal in Wyoming. Wyoming's numbers are good numbers, but they have a different situation. North Dakota, we've got a lot of growth that's going on. We are going to have to add about 960 megawatts of power in the next 5 years to the state to meet the load. We're going to need, we project, 2,500 megawatts of power in the next 20 years. So when you look at that from a growth perspective, in North Dakota, we feel we're in pretty good shape as we grow. With the regulations that are out there, kind of puts us out of touch from building a new coal plant, so we'll probably have to meet that with gas and wind and renewables. South Dakota, again, we've got, they have tough numbers, but most of what we've got there is wind, along with the Deer Creek Station, which has been the topic of a lot of conversation today. And just to make sure that everyone understands, even though we appreciate EPA's attempt to get us a new market to selling all of our power in South Dakota, we do understand the situation that came up with EPA's looking at Deer Creek. We agree with what's been said here about EPA's view of Deer Creek was wrong, and we think what they did on that was didn't account for that. That was a startup. It ran, we believe, the last month of the year. So we agree and are supportive of what Otter Tail and MDU are trying to express to EPA on that. With our plants in North Dakota, when you look at what's been going on with regional haze, we've got a lot of conflicting EPA regulations that we are trying to get to. You look at our Leland Old Station, we've just completed a multi-million dollar project there to handle mercury emissions from that project. We are also investing a lot of money into our Antelope Valley Station to meet regional haze issues. You go to Wyoming, where there was a federal FIP put down that said we have to put selective catalytic SCRs on that plant. That's a $750 million investment on that plant that's supposed to be completed by 2019, and at the same time, we have now the 111D rules are supposed to kick in 2020. So like a lot of the other utilities, we are kind of getting caught in a bind here between handling existing rules and trying to foresee what we're supposed to do with that plant when new rules come through. I think that's kind of the main things we've got with the plant. Deer Creek. One thing I want to talk about, there's such a lot of talk on the EPA building blocks, and a lot of questions come up. And in conversations and different meetings with EPA folks, what the message that seems to come down is they put together the blocks to develop the state number, and that was the only purpose for that. And from that point on, you're supposed to just ignore the blocks and do whatever you want or whatever you can to get to that number. So I guess I agree with the rope analogy that, you know, you do whatever you want, but, you know, the building blocks, they, from what EPA says, we use them to develop the numbers, and from that point, in essence, we've dumped it on the state, and it's now your problem to figure out. So, and with that, don't let Scott Handy's clean-cut, aw shucks boy, fool you. He is one of our best and brightest. We're darn glad to have him as part of our industry. With that,
he's a bison, just for
the yeah. We'll let that one go. We've got, with that, I don't know if there's any things you want to talk about, or we can jump into the...
Why don't you do yours?
Okay, let's run through the presentation. As the chart you see in front of you and what's up there, it's kind of our generation capacity portfolio right now. At this point, 59% of our approximately 5,500 megawatts of generation is coal. We've got 17% of it is natural gas, 14% of it is renewables. We've got a little bit of hydro at 6%, 3% being oil or diesel, and then a small slice being nuclear, which is a part of a plant. We picked up a new member in Iowa, and part of the generation they brought in was part of the a plant down in Iowa that is a nuclear plant. What we've been doing internally, as Jim talked about, we set up an internal task force before the rule came out to kind of talk about what was going to happen. And after the rules come out, they've been very busy trying to develop how we address this. I was very impressed with what the what MDU and the others have done. They're in my mind probably further along than we are on this. With our internal task force, we looked at three main questions, or they're looking at three main questions. How would we develop a state-by-state plan? If the rule ends up with what it is now, how would we change our operations to meet the rule in each state that we operate in? Second part, how would we develop a multi-state plan? And then how do we develop a utility plan? I mean, when EPA was running around here before this rule came out, they were saying, we got all this flexibility, you're going to have all these choices, you can do multi-state, you can do state, you can do your own plan. But now if the rules comes out, I guess we agree with they've been kind of short on answers on how this actually gets done. But that's what we're looking at from a company, saying, okay, if the states are going to do this and states will put the plan together, how would we want this done? The task force, we're developing comments both for public hearings and for our October for the submission of comments, and then we're also looking at what can be done legally to address the issue. We've got about five main points that we've got with the rule. Number one, we do support a multi-state and utility compliance option to provide the maximum flexibility for utilities that serve in multiple states. I guess we were very happy to hear that there's other utilities in the state that agree with that, that would like to go down that road. We think there's several reasons to do that. Number one, this is just a proposed rule. We don't know exactly what the final is going to do, and we think that having the ability to work as with multiple utilities in multiple states on answers will help us. We don't know what's going to happen in 2030. We think there's strength in numbers from a compliance and a legal position. And then from a purely practical standpoint, it gives us an extra year to come up with a state plan if we go down that road. The second item we have is we say that EPA should ensure that energy efficiency improvements should not trigger new source review. You've heard a lot of talk today on what can be done at the plants, and we agree. We haven't been sitting on our hands letting these plants run willy-nilly. You know, every employee at those plants, that's their job one, is how do you make the plants better? How do you keep them running better, running smoother, more efficiency? So it's not something that we've been waiting for. Sure, there are some slight improvements that can be changed with maybe some operational changes, but it's a give and take. You'll gain something to lose something. So you can maybe squeeze a couple percentage or more out of there. 6% improvements will require significant modifications, and we're concerned that the major modifications could trigger new source review. This is one of our strong points with ESPA before this came out, saying if you're going to do this, allow modifications to take place without triggering new source review. And we were disappointed when that came out and it didn't happen. Our third concern is any project that reduces CO2 emissions should be allowed for compliance. We understand that reductions must be verifiable and measurable. And you've heard a lot of talk about the energy efficiency, and I've heard from utilities and from state people, this is their biggest problem with this. How do you make it verifiable and enforceable from the utility side and the state side? And from our standpoint, we're a little bit biased on this. We've got Dakota Gasification out there that's been capturing CO2 for approximately 12 years, and there are no provisions to allow that to count for any type of sequestration. So we would like to see some provisions put in to do that.
What would that look like, Dale? I get what you're trying to say, but how would that be put in, implemented?
If you're looking at a compliance side, we're saying that anything you can do that would reduce CO2 should be allowed on your compliance. So if we're capturing CO2 of a plant, that should count for our compliance numbers.
Gotcha. If we build something in the future that captures the CO2, then that should be put some number in there.
And there's so many other options that are out there as far as what can be done to do things. You've got agricultural sequestration. You've got a lot of things that are out there. If our goal is to reduce CO2, then anything that can be done should be counted. Number four, EPA should reconsider its 70% capacity factor for redispatched natural gas. This one's been hit pretty hard today. Maybe technically feasible, but it's going to reduce coal plant efficiencies and in a lot of cases may violate existing permits. I mean, when we do these, there's emission limits that are put on some of those plants, sometimes, you know, limited on runtime. So that is something that we're going to get into. And I think we're going to have that problem of, you know, what do you run and what do you violate? Do you violate reliability or do you violate environmental laws? The last one is on renewable energy credits. Again, do green take stay with the generation state or follow the load? The law and proposed rule are unclear regarding who has the authority to designate and manage. And so that's something that we think just needs to be clarified on that. And with that, I know that Lyle's got some. All right, if I answer any questions on that, if not, I'll turn it over to Lyle to offer his comments.
Just direct discussion. Basin was kind of the lead on the commission making a decision on what to do with these RECs a few years ago. How do you see that playing out with do RECs follow the generating state or follow the load? Isn't that clear now where they go?
Well, and you want to? In Basin's letter case, we have gone through where we used to keep the renewable energy credits. Say when we bought the power from a wind farm from, say, Lake Sterra, we kept the credits. being member-owned, being those are not our credits, those are our members' credits. And we have, through the years, developed a policy where those credits go to our member systems. So they aren't ours. They go, and so you've got our members in South Dakota, in Minnesota, in Iowa. They have receiving the credits right now. So, okay, if the credits are not ours, they're down in Iowa or South Dakota, where do we count those? And so it's just the clarification on that point.
Wouldn't they follow wherever the recs go to?
In our case, I don't believe that's clear.
You talked about Leland Olds and the regional A's improvements actually making this situation worse. And others today have talked about that with other plants. Is that because you use so much of your power in order to run the emissions equipment and they're only calculating the amount of power that you sell at retail? And so you're using more coal for less power, or the same amount of coal for less power, or am I understanding that incorrectly?
For the rules based on net megawatt hours generated from each plant, when you add a pollution control device, that increases the parasitic load for pollution control. And that's, depending on the plant, that can be in the range from 6, 8, 9, 10%, but the more pollution control you add, the higher that parasitic load is, so your net megawatt hours goes down and your pounds per megawatt hour then goes up because you still have the same amount of gross generation, same amount of power, but your rate of emissions goes up because it's based on net generation. So that's part of the answer. Okay, another important... No, go ahead if you want to.
Well, so in all my thoughts about Sask Power and their CO2 capture, that's probably not even going to, that would probably be a negative if that worked out well and we were to adopt that on plants here, because they're getting like a third
the load.
So it would
parasitic.
Actually move us backwards if they're not going to count the carbon that we sequester. But you're going to lose a third of your net load.
It would probably make your rate go down also. But you're going to have to replace that generation with something else. And if you replace it with coal, then you're really not that far ahead. Another component though of the regional haze is the idea that we put a $400 million scrubber on the back end of Leland Olds. They put a $400 million scrubber on the back end of Minn Kota. There was an attempt to force our cyclone boilers in North Dakota, at least the Minn Kota and Leland Olds that were BART eligible, to put on SERs. All of those were based on, there are two issues, whether it's available technology and then the cost of it. And they calculated that was cost effective based on the idea that they're going to have a remaining useful life of at least 20 years. Now they come out with a rule that might limit the ability of that plant to run at all, let alone 20 years. So that's that remaining useful life issue is something I want to talk a little bit more. But that's a fundamental part of not only the parasitic load, so it become less efficient, but also that remaining useful life issue is, I think, a fundamental issue that the commission has to deal with, and the department.
And with the regional haze, you know, again, competing regulations, where regional haze rule was nothing about health, it was all about visibility. The idea that we're going to have no outside impacts on visibility by 2064. And so we're putting in equipment in North Dakota, we're supposed to put in equipment in Wyoming just for visibility on that portion of it. So we've got that rule along with the mercury rule that we're handling with Leland Olds on that as well. Is that the same thing's going on at Big Stone? So one thing I didn't quite finish was looking at North Dakota as far as meeting the rules. We've got growth here. We think we can have the ability to meet our numbers through growth and what we have to add in generation. South Dakota, unless you're adding wind, we don't see how you can add anything in South Dakota for generation. Wyoming, we've got a problem there, because there's not the growth. Wyoming does not have the growth going on there. They've got a lot of federal lands, which limits our ability to put a lot of renewables in, so we've got an operational situation. So when we look at a regional plan, it would be great for us to combine Wyoming, South Dakota, and North Dakota, so that we could use the wind in South Dakota to help us out in Wyoming, the growth in North Dakota to help us out in Wyoming, and combine it all together. Now, in deference to what else has been said here today, I don't think that that developing a regional plan is going to would be that difficult with the minds that we've got in this room to do that. I think that can be done.
Is Wyoming's situation similar to ours?
Yes.
In this, or more similar to South Dakota and Minnesota, or
there's a huge difference between North Dakota and everybody else. In North Dakota, I'm going to get to one of your initial questions that you ask. But in North Dakota, we have more load growth than anybody else. So it came out as a rate base or carbon intensity based program. And the state plan that eventually will have to be approved will have a numerator, which is the amount of pounds or the number of tons that are emitted from those sources that are covered, those existing sources in existence before January 2014, all those emissions from those sources, that will be your numerator. And your denominator is the net megawatt hours produced. And what goes into that net number on the denominator is important because they include the renewables. You can add renewables to the denominator. If you add a combined cycle or gas, you can add some to the numerator, a lot to the denominator if the state chooses that option. But North Dakota is probably in the best shape of anybody because of that load growth. We can add enough low carbon intensity resources and not have to reduce the mass of emissions in the state. And in fact, we could potentially even increase the mass of emissions as long as we increased the denominator enough and got credit for that enough to meet the state number. So that's a big, if they would switch to a pure mass-based system and we had to cap our emissions at 2005 or 2012 and then reduce it 15 or 30%, we would go from being the state that's in the best shape because of our load growth, because of that demand in the Bakken that's going to continue to grow. We would be worse off than anybody by far. So that distinction between mass and rate is something that's really important that the policy people in North Dakota understand the importance of that particular part of this rule for this state. That gives us a way to grow our way into compliance rather than to have to shut down existing resources and replace them with wind and gas and other low carbon intensity. So if there's anything, any point that hasn't been made here today, and I didn't hear it made, but if there's anything that you need to understand that was a good thing that came out of this rule for North Dakota is that it had that rate-based approach, and that because of our particular situation, we can grow into compliance, building the wind and the gas resources that are the only thing we can really permit under 111B or the new source performance standards anyway, building those resources and including those as compliance options. That is really important for us to understand as a state and actually as a region. Wyoming doesn't have that load growth, so they don't have that same potential to grow into compliance as North Dakota. In fact, because the use of coal is going down and a lot of their load is coal, they are probably going to have potentially some reduced demand. So they're in a little different position. They have very similar numbers to us. So does Montana. Montana is probably potentially more like us than anybody. But South Dakota has that kind of unique situation where one major coal source left, one new combined cycle, and how does that fit into the picture for the consumers that are served in North Dakota from those resources? So I want to follow up on something Scott said, and there's another part of the rule that really hasn't been touched on that I think really you need to understand for us to really kind of approach this. EPA they have kind of a in the rule they have a proposal how state plans will be approved and how they'll be approvable, what criteria they're going to use to judge it, and what components those plans are going to have. There's 12 components to them. We won't go through them. There's four sets of criteria. We won't go through them. But then they have four kinds of options on ways states can approach it. And I do want to talk about those four a little bit because I think that's critical, again, for you to understand. And they talk about flexibility, but there really isn't the flexibility that's needed within those four possible approaches to really make it work up here in this region. That's the other point I want to make today. They give four options. There's a mass-based unit approach. Each unit in a state plan could have a mass limit. Or they can have a rate-based approach, and that would primarily involve something like the 6% coal fine drying, whatever options are out there, waste heat, co-powering, all those kinds of things. But that would be another way of making reductions. And you could have for each plan could be based on that. The third option is a state-driven portfolio approach, and that's where they take all four of those building blocks and each individual utility and each individual plant wouldn't necessarily have to comply with that state number, but the state plan as a whole would have to show compliance with that number. And again, the compliance number is going to be total tons, net megawatt hours, divide that bottom into the top if you're underneath that state goal, whatever that final is in the final rule, whatever that number is. That's if they can show that and show enforceability and verifiability, then that plan will be approved. And the enforceability, you've asked some of the hard questions, and I'm willing to go into those if you want some more on that. But that fourth building block, those are the first three, that state-driven portfolio. The fourth approach is a utility-driven portfolio approach. Now, that could be within a state border, but our utilities are not operated and not the resources aren't built on a state-by-state build. It's across the system that we serve, and that's especially true for our co-op system, which was built on top of the Missouri River Dam system. So we've for the last 50 years kind of been an independent transmission system built on top of the federal system, and now that's changing some, but that essentially for Basin, that's Basin Electric, Missouri Basin, and that's who we are. That's where we came from, serving that load that the dams couldn't serve. So once there was more load than the dams could supply, so that's who we are, and that's how we grew to serve that load. But the utility approach, and this goes back to how state air plans are now. So what each company does, they got to show compliance with the national ambient air quality standards, for example, and then they have to look at the emissions from each of the plants, and they put out monitors, and then they do modeling to show you're under it. And there's all sorts of issues that we've dealt with for a couple decades on modeling versus monitoring and whether you're in compliance or not. But essentially, it's basically taking that emission and looking at the impact. This rule is not it's not based on a system like that. It's based on a concept that 30% that you asked about, 15% of that was accomplished by 2012. There was a 15% reduction from 2005 to 2012. By taking 2012 numbers, they essentially locked in that 15% reduction. So NSP, Xcel, basically, because they did that lock-in and did it very simple way, they're kind of a victim of their own acting too early, really, in some ways. But I agree that's not fair, but that's essentially, and most of that reduction, and that 15% reduction, the building blocks were taken from things that were successful in 2005 to 2012 to make those reductions. All the new renewables, all the natural gas that because of the low cost of shale gas that then replaced all the old coal, because it was actually cheaper for a while to run natural gas instead of coal. But that's where that second building block came from, and that's their justification that it's a proven a way of making such a reduction. Yeah, the utility-driven portfolio approach basically, and it would be very close to what we've done. But for each state, you take the generation in that state, you designate what's subject to that state, and then all you have to you take for each it's all about tracking emissions and tracking megawatt hours in each state. And under EPA's suggestion, how you do a multi-state plan is you take, let's take South Dakota and North Dakota as an example. You take the 36 million net megawatt hours of generation, including hydro. Good. But that 36 million net megawatt hours that were generated in 2012 and the 36 million tons of emissions that came from the North Dakota generation in 2012. That's that 1998 number that EPA came up. That was our number for North Dakota. And you'd combine that with South Dakota, you'd back out the hydro there. It was 36 million without the hydro. Anyway, they had 3 million tons of generation, 3 million tons of emissions and 6 million tons. You'd add those two together and you'd have 39 million tons of emissions and 42 million net megawatt hours, and that would be your number for your two states. So actually doing a deal with a plan with South Dakota really wouldn't change North Dakota's numbers so much, because we have so much more generation and so much more. It wouldn't really affect the number. But you could do if you talk to the folks in EPA headquarters, and they're open to this idea, is if you show equivalency to doing that on a statewide basis within a utilities portfolio, under a utilities portfolio, so you can show the equivalent reductions across your system that you would get in it, as if those two states had made that kind of a plan, that would be something that would potentially solve it for us. And if you look at the numbers that you saw here today, MDU's numbers, they've gone from 27 million pounds per megawatt hour to less than 1,900 projected, right? And Otter Tail's numbers, they went from, I forget, but they went from, you end up about 1830, right? And again, it's a very large reduction. So there's probably, if you can balance and weight across state lines, it's probably going to work for most utilities in this region, because they're probably in pretty close to the same position that we are on this, because of the wind that's been added and because of the numbers that, so I think a utility based approach where the numbers for each utility, we serve different states, we serve different grids, but we have that in common, and if the states would agree that that is an approach that they could allow in each state, then you just use the number in each state, and it would be a matter of just simply transferring the megawatt hours around and coming up so that you meet the weighted average that you'd have to meet in those states, and that's something I think is worth exploring anyway.
Not the reality. My viewpoint is that still the PSC is giving away their jurisdiction.
I mean, no, that's the PSC.
But number we got to drive to.
But the PSC might actually take jurisdiction over that, or that might be something that.
That's where it gets challenging for me, where the differences between an investor-owned and the co-ops. I mean, I'm really glad everybody's in here discussing this today. But your viewpoints, you'll follow your stuff with Dave, what you think. And I think the investor-owns, it's the rate recovery piece. I mean, if the production tax credits are gone, you can't grow your way into this thing.
No, you can't grow your way unless you got load growth. That's the hard part.
Well, but even the there's so many variables out there, I guess. I'm not trying to dismantle what you're saying because I think it's got a lot of. You're telling us how we could do a state plan.
I'm suggesting approaches that might work if we explore them further. I'm not saying they're going.
But it's still
work.
That cost component of what it takes to do it. That's all these things you're saying are perhaps true, but we're ignoring all the cost components of it.
But I'm not quite sure what cost you're referring to,
well,
because you're going to have
add a whole bunch more wind if the production tax credit's gone. You can't add some. I mean, there's all those things that aren't included in what you're saying that you've got to cost these things out before a company decides to build something.
That's true.
That's the only thing I'm saying.
But there's a potential. No, I'm not saying it's easy. I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying that that of all the bad solutions, there might be a least painful one, but they're all painful. They're all going to be challenging. But under existing law, keeping it as simple as we possibly can, just using the energy intensity that's generated, taking advantage of the fact that we do have load growth in this region, and they did come forward with the rate-based system. There may be paths forward that are less painful than others, and we should explore those. And I don't think that they're just less painful for Basin. I think they're less painful from all in North Dakota generation.
I have a question, Lyle, and we might be a little bit ahead of ourselves here, but I'm on the verge of understanding what you're saying, so I want to ask this question now. On the utility-driven portfolio approach, mm-hmm. So are you saying that you decide which states you're going to work together, and everybody throws their target together and divides it by their total megawatts. So you come up with an average for the states, and then every utility tries to or has to meet that average.
Okay.
I know that's overly simplistic, but
that's kind of it. But there's certain things you're going to have. You can't double count any of the winds. So if a green tag is counted in Minnesota, it can't be counted in North Dakota. But you can't double count any of the emissions either. So if under our state plan, to meet our 1,783 pounds in 2030, those pounds of generation are counted in North Dakota, they cannot count those as they cross into Minnesota because mm-hmm. they've already been counted once in North Dakota. So each megawatt hour and each pound of generation or ton of emission has to be counted once, and nothing can be counted twice. That's got to be a fundamental component of it. And then you have to have an accounting system where you can track that. So and once you have those two things, then it should be possible to, across your system, to get a weighted average to show equivalency as if within a utility plan to the reductions you would get in each state if you met the standard in each state. So Otter Tail potentially could move some of their, and MDU could move some of theirs to North Dakota because they've got wind generation in North Dakota, and they could average to meet the standard here. And they're going to have to show equivalence in CN somehow, but I think that ability to move it back and forth might be something that we want to make sure that EPA allows in the final rule. I don't know that we can draw it out, but that flexibility. All I'm saying is in the comments, we need to ask for more flexibility on the utility-driven portfolio approach and show how we can get the equivalent reductions at less cost than if we are stuck with trying to do it within the state borders. And I think it's just going to be impossible to do that in our energy-exporting states like North Dakota and like Wyoming, where some of Wyoming's power goes to Oregon and Washington State and California and Utah and our power goes to all the states that we serve and those are different states than those states. So I think it's going to be impossible to get a trading program that's going to work if it's state, if they have to come up with that state portfolio approach. I don't see how that's going to possibly work, or if you're going to limit it to just the states. Just the states. I think you're going to have to do it on a portfolio basis, and then make that as part of that state implementation plan that each utility files, and then that's got to be enforceable against that utility in each of those states to whatever number that finally has to be met. So, for example, it doesn't matter if in one state, it shouldn't matter under the state plan if for some utilities they have a mass-based approach because they do not have a growing load, and for other utilities have a rate-based approach. If in the end the state plan that's approved by EPA shows that they meet that final number based on the number that goes into the numerator and the numbers that go in the denominator. It shouldn't matter whether some of it's rate, some of it's mast. It's going to be really complicated if Dave and Tom and Maggie have to figure that out. And you folks on Building Block 4 and on Remaining Useful Life, I think you have a central role to play there too. If you have to figure that out, but I think if we can try and figure that out on a utility-by-utility basis and show equivalency, I think that's still not a very good solution. None of us like this approach. And you still make your legal challenges. You don't give away your legal challenges by suggesting these things. You don't have authority to go outside the fence line. You don't have authority to step into the state's role in setting standards of performance. The statute says that states are supposed to be able to consider remaining useful life. There's nothing in the rule that really makes that meaningful. They have nothing in the rule that guards against stranded investment. That is in the statute. EPA does not adequately. That's a legal challenge that I really encourage the states to really push on, because that is a real weakness legally. And it's there in the statute, and those are the kind of statute that you win in court if you have something. The statute says one thing, EPA is doing the something that's not consistent with that. That's the legal challenge you can win in a court of appeals. And that's those kinds of challenges. Do not give those away. You make those comments so you have that ability to raise those issues with the courts of appeal or the single court of appeal, whether some of it will go through one court, D.C. Circuit, others will go through the...
Did you get an answer?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
So... Fair enough. Anything else? Must be more.
I do have one other question for Dale. You said on number three that there currently isn't a mechanism to allow for emission reductions with CO2 capture. I thought, though, early on you said that they basically said, here's the goal, get there however you want. So how is this not one of the ways?
And we'll in our comments we'll think that it should be part of it. But at this point, the Dakota Gasification Plant, since it's not an electric generator, is completely ignored with the rules. You know, both their emissions and any capture that we do off of that. But again, if the goal of this is to reduce CO2 into the atmosphere, we think that any action that takes place, whether that be with us driving, with farming practices, with operations of any kind, should count towards compliance.
120 megawatts of it takes 120 megawatts hour to run DGC day in and day out. So, and about well over a quarter of that is just for the compressors on the CO2. So there is a lot of our electric load is related to that facility for AVS, from our AVS facility. And we do have tons that are sequestered. So there is under Building Block 4, with the help of maybe support from the commission and others, a way of approaching that as a way of getting credit from that, because it is related to demand side reduction, especially the compressor and the CO2 part. But I think more of it actually. So that is something we are going to include in our comments. But that's kind of unique to Basin.
I liked your point about how switching from rate base to mass base could switch North Dakota from being one of the best off states to maybe the worst off state. And it helps to make this point without sounding so selfish. So I appreciate that you trying to do the best for almost 3 million consumers in 9 states want to balance some of this stuff out over those nine states and make the impact less dramatic in certain areas. But for us, whose constituency is the people that live in the state of North Dakota, or for the legislature that would probably have to make some legal changes with the same type of constituency, why would we want to share the circumstances that makes North Dakota better off? Or if it got switched to a mass base, then why would one of the other states want to share the circumstances that makes them better off when a few years down the road, maybe EPA ratchets this up some more and then we need those worse again? You know, it might not impact us too much to share now, but later on it may.
There are several parts to that answer. I'll try and focus on two or three of them. Let's take wind. They're not going to build any more wind in North Dakota if they can't get credit for those companies that, if they can't get credit for those state that in the states that they need it. So just developing that resource to continue to develop it, and it makes sense to develop it where you have the best resource because that's most cost effective and you get the most bang for your buck if you place it where you have the best wind resource. So part of it is if you try and be selfish and just keep all those in state, you're basically going to balkanize and make it so you only this companies are going to have to build the wind in the state where they need the credit instead of building where it's most cost effective. The second part.
With Excel Energy, that we don't want them building stuff to North Dakota ratepayers that don't need in North Dakota. So it's a very good point he brings out. But I you guys got a tough.
But here's because you have different numbers. Our wind in South Dakota doesn't do us any good, but if we can transfer those credits to North Dakota and Wyoming, where they on our system, that's what they're there for, and we can get credit for them. That averages it down, but we can also Otter Tail can transfer some of their and MDU some of their maybe up here and take advantage of the wind. So you got the wind resource here, and then they have a number maybe they can live with. More likely, you got to run the numbers. You got to figure out how to do a multi-state utility-driven portfolio approach and what EPA will accept in that sec. But that's part of it. The gas resource. If that gas resource, if you can transfer within your system that megawatt hour up to North Dakota, it helps bring down the average in North Dakota. It hurts in South Dakota because it's higher than their number. So that benefits North Dakota and South Dakota by allowing that transfer of the wind credits. And most of those winds in North, South Dakota and South Dakota are to customers that people in this room. Some of them are Minnesota Power, and some of the other ones are mostly. But I think it, because of the load growth and because of the numbers that we have, there's a good chance that if we look at it, that it's something that potentially could work if they allow the flexibility that we would need to allow that kind of approach. But I think it's a win-win. I don't think it's a win-lose for any state in this region to allow that. I don't know how they build with all the sage-grouse issues and other issues in Wyoming. I don't know how they build the wind that they need and if you can build more wind in your state, that's something that's going to, or you can take advantage of from another state that allows you to continue to run that coal resource in Wyoming by allowing that wind credit to be used in Wyoming from another state. So it isn't win-lose. It most likely is win-win when you allow the most cost-effective use of those resources and allow them to be balanced across that company's system. You got to run the numbers, and I think once you start looking at the numbers, it can be win-win if each utility has that flexibility.
Okay. Commissioners, maybe just one extra point on that utility-based portfolio thought. You know, we've kicked around several ideas. Certainly, don't have what the ultimate answer is, but You know, maybe one what-if scenario is the states, you know, keep the targets that they have, but allow the utilities like Basin Electric to, you know, come up with a plan that, you know, shows that they meet compliance or equivalency to compliance within each of those states. So, you know, I guess the concept would be that, you know, a company like Basin Electric might show, you know, the states that they have generation in and what the actual generation and the actual emissions were, and then have the ability to, you know, allow sort of this shifting of, you know, X amount of the megawatt hours with their associated intensity of carbon, whether it's no carbon emissions or higher carbon emissions, so that, you know, we could explain this is what the actual generation was in associated emissions. These are, you know, the transfers, so to speak, made, and then, you know, demonstrating that equivalency within each of those states. That way, you know, the states aren't kind of fighting or worried about, I guess, different, you know, target numbers, giving up, losing, you know, and might be a source of flexibility for us to better, you know, comply with this rule that's been laid out. But something that we're trying to get our arms around and want to try to make some meaningful comments in October.
So how would you, I'm tracking, I think, what you're saying here, but, you know, Basin's a little bit different. You're not regulated by us.
Right.
So you make this decision, and then you take your cost divided by however many co-ops that you're, how many, you know, like God Handy's of the world you're going to sell it to, and you divide it by whatever that number is. How would you recommend the PSC do it if it's something built in North Dakota clearly to help South Dakota? Would you put all those costs on South Dakota ratepayers? Because with North Dakota ratepayers, how would you break those costs out?
The cost for building the new generation resources to meet the rule? Yeah. That's a good question. You know, I think it would probably, you know, one way to do that would be, you know, based on where that utility's load is and, you know, the proportion that way of where that load's being served. but certainly if the flexibility was allowed to, you know, shift those around within the states served, you know, within a utility like an Otter Tail or MDU or whomever, and Basin Electric for that matter, you know, we could take advantage and site the generation resources where it makes the most sense, not, you know, associated with.
You allocate cost. How do you allocate to your different co-ops, if you will?
Well, we set an average, or, you know, we set our utility rates, and we socialize those rates across the entire membership.
Mm. All right. Dave, you must have a couple questions. Concepts.
I don't know if I have any questions. Just maybe after listening to everybody, just kind of more comments than anything. I will say that I've been to a lot of public hearings and public meetings, and when I hear somebody reference hanging, I get a little bit nervous. but that was a good analogy. When I look at this, put the rule aside, is that there's been a lot of good work already been done. Aside from any regulation saying you got to do this, there's been a lot of wind generated. There's been a lot of the companies have been moving forward, addressing this issue. I get the sense that, you know, this is just having that storm cloud out in the distance, companies are moving that direction. But I also get the sense that given the flexibility, I think they would continue to move down that path, looking at a diverse portfolio that includes renewables, that includes coal and everything else, which I think is where the health of the whole industry is. And I also, it's not lost on me, is but for customers out of state, there wouldn't be some of the facilities we have in the state. And so, you know, it's really easy to say keep it within the state lines, but we need some of those folks outside the state lines so we can continue to operate. I do think that I would like to see if the rules continue to move forward, provide a little more certainty, because I do think after 2030 there's still a big question mark for me. How do we move forward here? And I get it. The comment about anything that reduces carbon should be included. The early action concerns, I do think there should be more flexibility because companies have been moving forward, like I said, to address the CO2. But when I hear include everything from you know, farming practices and all that other stuff, just trying to get accountability for the demand side, I may lose hair like Tom after a while. So I get, you know, it would be a tough thing. So the point I want to make is I really appreciate the companies coming forward and saying, hey, I didn't hear hell no from any of the companies, but I heard that, you know, there are some challenges here as we move forward. Also heard that they've done a lot of good things. So with that being said, it just still everything's up in the air. I do appreciate this opportunity because it provided some answers but created a lot more questions too.
Well, I have a question, and it could be for any of the companies, but since Basin's here, I'll direct it at you. But throughout the day, you know, I've heard any number of things, you know, if they will allow this and if we could do that, you know, this might lessen the problem, whether it's from counting Deer Creek as under development to a unit or a utility-based approach or all kinds of different things. And it seems to me that operates under the assumption that EPA wants this to work. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that I share that belief or that assumption. But it seems like everyone I've heard speak today kind of is coming from that perspective. If you have that perspective, why not just have a federal a FIP? Why bother with the state plans?
Well, I think I'll go after that. But with our perspective, we're going down dual tracks. I mean, from a legal standpoint, we think there's a lot of opportunities to defeat this legally. But that being said, that's going to be a 3 to 5 year process, we fear, before we get it done. I mean, we can't do anything until the final rule comes out, which is going to be June 2015. And if it's a 3 to 5 year process, we may not get a ruling until 2018 or 2020. At which times we're supposed to be there and meet target goals. So we've got dual tracks going on where we go, what do we do if we have to meet it? You know, if we get legal challenges, fine. Then I don't know that we've wasted all this work, but we don't have to implement all this work. But so we're still going down the dual track of legal versus the other and just trying to find out if we have to implement it, what is the best way to do that? And we think using any kind of a state plan that we could agree to is going to be much better than the feds coming in saying, here's what you will do. And so that's why we want to do what we can to make sure we have a state plan, even, you know, individual or multi, versus a federal plan.
I'll give you a legal answer and try and make it not too long. The Clean Air Act, really, the authority to regulate health and welfare was a state function until the Clean Air Act was passed, the Clean Water Act was passed. And they preempted some of that state authority, but that's still primarily, under our Constitution, a state function. And this Clean Air Act kind of preserves that state role in that in the EPA sets national standards where it involves national health things or visibility or any kind of an excuse where it becomes a reason. But under this particular law, 111D, the law preempts the authority of states to establish performance standards for new facilities. It does not preempt the authority for existing facilities. So they have to act within that framework. And also, it has that remaining useful life component that they're kind of ignoring that really needs to be hammered on by the states, because that stranded investment issue is really fundamental to that. So, but the reason that they have to do it on a state-by-state basis is because the law does not allow them to send a single national standard. And a single national standard would have been really bad for us. Or it doesn't allow them to set up a national cap-and-trade standard. John Graves was right. I think John's has left, but he's also right that they're under those four building blocks. Only the first building block really falls within EPA's traditional authority. The other arguments really are really kind of rely on state authority, things like energy efficiency, demand side efficiency, renewable portfolio standards, that dispatch issue, and That is a fundamental change. Instead of doing economic dispatch, and that's how all grids have historically been operated, so that the least cost resource when they're dispatching is always called on first, and then that's the next highest. What this is going to be a fundamental change, so it's dispatched according to its carbon intensity, at least in some cases, or at least within a certain, and that's a fundamental change, and that's going to increase the cost of electricity, depending a lot on the price of natural gas, because there's kind of an illusion in this rule that it's not going to cost much because the price of natural gas has been low as gas displaced coal between 2007 and 2012, and now it's still relatively low. But on the cost of generating electricity from natural gas, almost most of that cost is from the fuel, and when you increase the cost of that fuel, your price of natural gas goes up linearly. With a coal plant, on a BTU basis, coal is a lot cheaper. Your costs there are a lot of it's the pollution control and other things that add to that cost. But the fuel is still really cheap compared to gas. So as you displace coal with gas and the price of natural gas jumps, then that's when you're going to see the big jump in your rates and things. And that's kind of hidden in this rule, that cost to the consumer. And how much is the price of natural gas going to go up when we switch all the coal to gas, and the supply isn't there, et cetera, et cetera, especially in high demand periods, in the peak demand periods in winter and summer when you need it the most. So the short answer is it's basically the difference in the law requires it to them to do it on a state-by-state basis.
Well, just I want to thank everyone for your time today and for all their good information and good discussion. We did allocate to 4 o'clock for this, but I don't think any of us expected to be here this long. So I think that illustrates a lot of the challenges here. I hope in everybody's comments that you all emphasize the dubious benefits of this program while you're talking about what needs to be done to make it workable. I think that's really important. And this is a very clever plan. They put it out and were able to get away with making it seem reasonable and not that extreme. But when you dig in, you realize it's anything but that. And this has serious impacts for consumers and for our country and our economy. So I think knowing that, there should be some real strong benefits in terms of environmental, and there isn't. So it really kind of makes me sick to see this kind of stuff moving forward when the public just doesn't understand what's going on this stuff. So at the same time, we do have a policy body that has been dealing with carbon regulation, and it's called Congress. And they have had carbon policy, and it's worked. You see it in this line. You see it in the lines of your reductions through the wind PTC and other incentives that have worked quite well. And so, again, another point to consider including is why not just increase the incentives or focus on incentives and allow the markets to adjust like they have been over the course of the last decade quite significantly. So that would be another point. Thirdly, I think that, you know, the state versus multi-state, it is tempting to say we've got a good North Dakota, let's keep it that way. But I think that, you know, Dave's ultimately the one that's going to be deciding that, what the approach is. And I think we have a harder challenge because our consumers are going to be paying for stuff in other states. So to me, that whole issue is not at all clear, and I think that there is some real reasons to keep the doors open for that type of flexibility to work together. So I heard the word fundamental change a lot today, and I think that I hope that we all continue to talk about that when we talk publicly about this issue, because people need to realize the impacts this is going to have. And thanks, Brian, for putting this workshop together.
I took your advice. Randy wants one more thing.
Well, to everybody that's here and that have already left, unfortunately, I know, you know, it's 7 hours of sitting here, but then plus travel time and plus countless hours of time preparing for this, I just really appreciate all the effort that's gone forth, because you've given me at least a lot of additional information, and it's valuable information that's going to be very useful in me as we go forward into our meeting in September with Commissioner Clark and NERC and others who are on the agenda, and then working with Dave and ultimately coming up with whatever comments are going to come out of this commission. So I just appreciate everybody's time and thoughtfulness and forthrightness.
Thanks, Randy. Thanks again, everybody. The 60 days, the comments are due, give or take. And so when you look at that, we've got our September 10th meeting that Commissioner Christman just talked about. But, Dave, if we could just figure out a time to talk to you. And do you want to talk before or after our September 10th? I think the three of us and you guys, you should sit down and we should just have a good candid discussion. Okay. So we'll get that on the queue. But just thanks, everybody. But that's why I see it playing out. They just said we'll have our get our comments from all of you, and we'll put something in there, and we'll just see where it goes. So thank you all.